Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a HIDA conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. HIDA, as in the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Areas, a program created by the Office of National Drug Control Policy in 1988 with the goal to support federal, state, local, and tribal law enforcement efforts in areas identified as critical centers for drug trafficking. There are roughly 33 HIDA regions across the United States, and they cooperate to disrupt and dismantle drug trafficking organizations. They establish intelligence centers for real-time information sharing, and they do much more. They have overdose response systems that bring together public health and public safety and even invest in drug prevention and treatment. To learn more about HIDA, I reached out to Director David King. David King was appointed Executive Director of the San Diego Imperial Valley HIDA in 2017 after 28 years of law enforcement service. He was named by Harbor Police Peace Officer of the Year in 1995 and has extensive experience in narcotic enforcement. His expertise is leadership in working collaboratively with a large spectrum of law enforcement organizations, and I know that he goes beyond and cooperates with public health. He currently serves as an elected member of the National HIDA Directors Association, NHDA. To learn more about Director David King, check out the High Truth show notes. I record this conversation with Director King on June 20th, 2022. Director David King, welcome back to High Truths.
Thank you, Dr. Lev. Great to be here.
And you know what? I pride myself that I've been going on for 5 years and very, very rarely do I have a guest twice. And it's amazing that there's so many conversation about drugs that I don't run out of amazing people to invite to the show. And you're one of the rare people that I want to bring again because there are new things and things that we should refresh about HIDA and what that is. So let's start with that.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So start with, tell us a little bit about yourself and what is HIDA?
Well, HIDA stands for HIDTA, High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area. It was a program created around 1992 by Congress to address then the crack cocaine epidemic and the violence that was around the country surrounding that. Today, it has grown to a $298 million federal grant program encompassing 33 HIDA regions, all 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands.
Wow. And how did you get involved in that?
I started my career as a local police officer, so I'll just kind of start there, kind of start at the ground and work my way up. Local police officer in 1989 here in San Diego, did that for 8 years. Fell in love with narcotic enforcement. I say that in the sense that everything on my beat pretty much revolved around alcohol and drugs, any kind of disturbances, assaults, rapes, robberies, burglaries, disturbances were all somehow narcotic related and alcohol related. And I soon realized that that was a passion that I wanted to try to help society by somehow lessening the impact of alcohol and drugs on my community. So I was a task force officer, did that for 3 years on a federal task force Then in 1997, joined the Bureau of Narcotic Enforcement, where I spent 20 years as a special agent, ultimately special agent in charge all around Southern California in various task forces specifically aimed at targeting methamphetamine, heroin, cocaine, later fentanyl. The last 8 years, I've been the director of the San Diego Imperial Valley HIDA, which is only two counties, but we're one of four regions in California, high-intensity drug trafficking regions, that get money from the White House, Office of National Drug Control Policy, under the Executive Office of the President. That money, that $298 million, is distributed to those 33 regions. Ours is roughly $12 million a year. For the federal, state, and local agencies, prosecutors, DA's office, U.S. attorney, police chiefs, sheriffs, to determine how to best address the threat of drugs in their area. 95% of the money from ONDCP and the HIDA program specifically has to go to law enforcement efforts. So that 36 years now of my career, roughly 33 of it has been spent in narcotic enforcement in one capacity or another.
And doing a lot of good and changes despite the fact that it's never ending.
It is never ending, but to me, there's no more important topic to discuss. There's no bigger threat to our country and its well-being and the well-being of our citizens and our future than the threat of addiction. Because where else can you go into a country and weaken it substantially without firing a single shot than to addict the people? And when you have roughly 100,000 people a year, which the last couple of years have been the case, over 100,000. It's going down, thankfully, because of the efforts of public health, public safety prevention. But you lose almost 100,000 people a year in a developed nation where 95% of the people that overdose don't die. And that tells you how many people are overdosing. I can't think of a more important matter to address for our overall health and well-being and our national security than the threat that drugs pose.
That's right. That's why there's many people now who want fentanyl to be declared a weapon of mass destruction. And we've learned that historically, right, with the opium wars in China, that these things are weaponized. And this has been a silent, deadly killer in a way of weakening our population.
Yeah, and it knows no socioeconomic boundaries. So unlike a military conflict where you have soldiers that sacrifice their life, you have civilians, everybody. It doesn't matter your socioeconomic boundaries. Drug addiction adversely impacts everybody. And with it, causes our GDP to decrease. Look at all the crime and homelessness. And I know the homeless population because here in San Diego, we're blessed to have the Substance Use Overdose Prevention Task Force. We've been on the front lines here in San Diego and Imperial County, as you know, for decades, fighting the different stages of the threat the drugs posed. For many years, we were weed and speed in San Diego, right? We were the methamphetamine manufacturing capital of the United States, practically of the world. But as we address the precursor chemicals that moved south, and we've lately been dealing with the last 5-6 years, the threat of fentanyl, but it's never ending. It's like painting the Golden Gate Bridge. You go from one end to the other, and it's just a never ending endeavor because we can never let our guard down. But what I'm really proud of is, like I said, like talking to you, and being on a monthly basis, sometimes a weekly basis, talking to our medical professionals, we're thinking outside the box. It's not just enforcement because we can't arrest our way out of it. We have treatment, we have prevention. So public health, public safety, and prevention, I always call the triangle. And I think that's why now we're starting to see some successes. And I'm really proud of the fact that we went from San Diego County, just over 1,309 back in 2021, unintentional overdose deaths with alcohol and drugs, to now we're in the range of about 917. So certainly much work to do, and I'm happy to do it, and I'm happy to be able to help those in law enforcement as well as public health and prevention.
Yes. And you know what? I know that you love it. You know how I know you love it? Because you have a son that's following your footsteps. That's always a telltale sign that in the home you show. I mean, law enforcement is a tough and it's, you know, for many years, people didn't want to go into that field. It was recruitment was a problem in it. And it, your son looked up to you and probably wants to be like you and followed your footsteps.
I mean, he is going to be much better than I was. I mean, the advances in technology and how they use social media and how they use all the equipment and advances and body-worn cameras. He's a much better officer than I was. And I also have a daughter who's an intelligence analyst at the Law Enforcement Coordination Center. So there isn't an operation that goes on with what we call event deconfliction, where they don't call into the San Diego Law Enforcement Coordination Center Watch Center. So she's intricately involved as well on the intelligence side. So boots on the ground, I guess we can consider it a family business. And it makes me a very proud papa.
That's great. And I relate to that too, because, you know, as an emergency physician, I know that I've come home and, you know, complained about things many times. And yet somehow it didn't deter my two daughters to go into medicine as well. And I relate to what you're saying. They're a lot better doctors than I was in their approach and technique and everything else as well.
Well, they use intelligence to their advantage. So where we as sometimes were a little bit reactive to the threat, they're extremely proactive. They use open source intelligence. The Chula Vista Police Department, I'll put in a plug for them. They have the reputation in the United States of being the most technically advanced police department in the United States. They use drones as first responders. They have live 911. So in the old days, we would get a call.
What's live 911? What does that mean?
Well, it's fantastic. So in the old days, when I was in patrol, you'd get a call from dispatch. There was a subject that had assaulted a victim. They were wearing whatever descriptive clothing eastbound on Harbor Drive. So that would come from a dispatcher. And oftentimes the dispatcher would have to be getting the information from the reporting party and then relaying that to the officers on the street. There could be a delay. Now they have live 911. So when that call comes in, the Cameron is hearing that, and the officers at the Chula Vista Police Department are hearing that as they respond to the location. They have a computer automated dispatch. They're linked directly to go to that location. And then on certain calls that are high priority, violent calls, they launch drones. So not only are they hearing the live report from somebody who is seeing that and reporting it, and the dispatcher doesn't have to translate that. Oftentimes, prior to arriving on the scene, they have a picture of the suspect or the scene, and they can respond appropriately. So it makes it much safer for the officers and the community. It makes them much more efficient.
Wow, that's great. So San Diego Imperial HIDA, there's 33 different highways around the United States. What is specific to San Diego?
I mean, we're unique, and I say this all the time. We're the number one drug transshipment point in the United States of America. So the majority of methamphetamine, just over 60% of the methamphetamine seized on the southwest border, and we're talking about California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. There are six southwest border HIDAs starting in L.A., San Diego. Arizona is considered one high-intensity drug trafficking area. New Mexico, West Texas, and South Texas. So not only are we unique among HIDAs, being a Southwest border HIDA, because when it was first created, all those six HIDAs were one region. Now we're independent because we realize it's better to control and to have autonomy in those regions. But what sets us apart and having only two counties is the volume of drugs coming from, obviously, from Mexico, and the threat that we face from transnational criminal organizations. And I say that from the TCO perspective. You can call it drug trafficking organizations, whatever you want. We have a very strong Sinaloa cartel presence and CJNG, Cartel Jalisco Nueva Generacion, which is fighting for control of the plazas just south of San Diego, Tecate, and then into Imperial County, Calexico. So we have 6 ports of entry. Those ports of entry screen millions of people a year. We have the world's largest border crossing, land border crossing in San Ysidro. Just over 70,000 vehicles a day cross through that, 35,000 pedestrians. So the threat that we face from transnational criminal organizations is immense in our region, because the population base in San Diego, with the county being just over about 3.5 million, just south of the border in TJ, several million people there, presents a lot of opportunities on a daily basis for the TCOs to smuggle the drugs across the border. So I go around the country, I speak all over the United States to law enforcement, prosecutors, members of the public about the threat that we face, because unlike Las Vegas, that what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, what happens in San Diego and Imperial counties, unfortunately, doesn't stay in San Diego and Imperial counties. So the drugs that we seize, and we tell this all the way up to the president, I briefed in the Oval Office, that if we stop a vehicle and it has 150 pounds of methamphetamine in it, the further north or the further east that it gets away from our ports of entry and our AOR, the less you're going to see in those vehicles. And by the time it gets to the Midwest, a vehicle stop with 10, 15 pounds of meth is quite significant. So we want to try to catch it as close to the source as possible. And that source right now is Mexico.
And you kind of like threw that in, that you got to brief the president in the Oval Office. What was that like? Were you nervous?
Yes. I think anytime you you can address the leader of the most powerful nation on the planet in the Oval Office, it was quite the opportunity. I found the president, this was during his first term, President Trump, to be very engaging, knew everybody's name, quite respectful, really supports law enforcement and the efforts of obviously first responders, federal, state, and local officers, and the HIDA program itself. I mean, so yeah, I was very nervous, and you get there and you see it in so many movies, and it's kind of surreal to be in the Oval Office. And you just think about all the significant events that have occurred in our nation's history and all the conversations that have transpired within those walls. And it's great to be a part of it.
Wow. It's smaller than you expect.
It is. Yeah. You walk in and you have the briefing room, the Eisenhower room, and you meet and they screen you. You have to go through multiple layers, and then you walk in and you're like, oh, wow, it's not as big as it seems, right? Like in all the movies and shows. Yeah. But it was quite an opportunity. And I had the opportunity to meet the vice president and members of his cabinet. So it was a day that I won't forget. And I hope to repeat during this current administration.
Yeah, quite an honor. The other things about San Diego is drug trends. As being the entry point of drugs to much of the United States, we can see new trends and, you know, chemically analyze that. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I said earlier that we were always, and I say a little bit slang because that's kind of how we talk when we take the suit off, that San Diego for many, many years was weed and speed, right? Marijuana, the threat to marijuana. And we'll talk about that later, I assume. It started with marijuana and it's now evolved into other drugs. And we still have that public health threat for marijuana. But for many years, we had methamphetamine and we were manufacturing meth. And then we controlled the precursor chemicals, pseudoephedrine. We started educating a lot of the merchants and businesses that were selling chemicals, going to Home Depot. So everybody now knows that if somebody comes in and they have pseudoephedrine, red phosphorus, hydriotic acid, you're like, oh, that's a lab. So what happened was, The Mexican cartels took all that production and they moved it south of the border. So the super labs were prevalent in California, really prevalent in San Diego County in the 90s when I was a young officer. And then later with the California Department of Justice, I was a supervisor for our regional clan lab enforcement program. So that was my specialty. All of those manufacturing went down to Mexico. So that was a playbook. But even before that, cocaine. So cocaine has not ever been really a big drug of abuse in San Diego County. It's been more LA and other parts of the country, but cocaine does come through our borders increasingly, and it is now in the last year increasing significantly. But if you look at the Mexican drug trafficking cartels, when I started, we were dealing directly with Colombians. And the Colombians were in Los Angeles. They were controlling the distribution routes and basically controlling all the profits from this illicit sales of cocaine. Well, the Mexican cartels said, no, give it to us in southern Mexico. We'll control it through Mexico and the distribution routes into the United States. And the Colombians were cut out of the picture. The Mexican cartels did the same thing with methamphetamine. And guess what? Right now, where you saw years ago a reliance on China for shipments of fentanyl into the United States, illicitly distributed fentanyl in the United States, you're now seeing that Mexico and the cartels are reaching out to chemists, and they want to control the precursor chemicals and reduce their reliance on China, which is the majority, with thousands of chemical distribution companies in China, and the vast majority are unregulated, shipping illicitly into Mexico. And then the Mexicans, the cartels, pill pressing and then controlling the distribution into the United States. So they did it with cocaine, they did it with methamphetamine, and now they're doing the exact same thing with fentanyl. And that's a huge threat, not only to our region and the state of California, but the entire United States as well, because they, as much as we look at China and India and try to control those countries from the shipments, Mexico doesn't have those same controls. The cartels have a much higher incidence of control geopolitically in those countries. So that's the real threat, is that now the cartels are cutting out their reliance and they're pushing it across the border, and the drugs, the prices continue to fall. So it's extremely cheap, readily available, and highly potent. And the cartel chemists have figured out a way to reconstitute methamphetamine. So there's D and L. And for your listeners, without getting too geekish and technical, the D methamphetamine is what every drug user wants. You could just say, I associate it for D for damn good. And the L would be lousy, waste, byproduct. They have figured out a way to reconstitute that L methamphetamine into D methamphetamine. And so whereas meth used to be $5,000-$6,000 per pound wholesale, we're now seeing it $500-$600 a pound, and it's 90% pure. So extremely cheap, readily available, and that makes it very difficult for the drug users, people who use drugs in our county and elsewhere to get off it.
We definitely see the horrible public health effects of that, of methamphetamine and fentanyl. And actually, methamphetamine is worse of a problem than fentanyl in San Diego, according to our drug report, medical examiner report, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, and you look at all of the societal consequences with methamphetamine, right? So the treatment modalities are few and far between, unlike with opioids, for which you're familiar with, and the aggression component for people who utilize for abuse methamphetamine. And it's a lot of our violence, a lot of our property crimes can be attributed to people, and it's highly addictive. And years ago, I mean, that's pretty much, like I said earlier, why I got into this, is because when I was on patrol, they would tell us in our lineups, hey, this store got burglarized, or these vehicles, there were like five break-ins, a couple auto thefts in this particular area on your beat. See what you guys can do about it. And the California Narcotics Officers Association had a training. And I want to say I started my patrol, got out of the academy in 90. In 91, I went to a class and learned the symptomology for being under the influence of a controlled substance. And we have a health and safety code Section 11550 Health and Safety Code in California, that in those days, you, if you were under the influence, and we still have 11550, but you would do 90 days in county jail. So I really quickly armed myself with a pupillometer and pen light and hit the streets. And I realized that it was all those, and you know, the slang term for people to use meth is tweakers, but all those people that were breaking into cars and getting into fights and, you know, those times occasionally overdosing were people who were under the influence of methamphetamine. So I'd see them and do the, you know, objective symptomology field survey on them, and I'd arrest them and they'd go away for 90 days in county jail. And what really made me happy is that sometimes 6-7 months later, I was walking my beat or driving or somewhere, and they'd come up, "Hey, Officer King." And I wouldn't recognize them. I'd be like, do yeah, I know you?
A different human being.
Yeah, I know it says King on my name tag here on my uniform, but they're like, "Oh, you arrested me last year and I was able to get clean." They gained 40 pounds. They had a job. They moved back in with family. And to me, that's what all of this is all about. It's not about incarcerating people and then locking them up and throwing away the key for those individuals that are under the influence. It's getting them the treatment and the help and the psychiatric and the medical attention that they need. Yeah. And quite oftentimes, the majority of the times, it's law enforcement that touches them first. So yeah, armed with 11550, we would knock out all of the sergeants and lieutenants. Months later would say, "Hey, that beat's really quiet. What did you do?" You know, I said, "We went in there and we arrested those people that the majority of the times were drug users and were stealing to support their habit." Because as you know, it's really difficult to hold down a full-time job and feed yourself when you have a habit. And they oftentimes turn to property crimes to do that.
Yeah, I tell people, you got your brain back. They got their brain back. Their brain was hijacked and they're able to get it back. Tunnels, that's something unique kind of to San Diego. I think there was recently a story about a tunnel that was found and destroyed connecting Mexico and San Diego for the purpose of drugs. Let me ask you, what are these tunnels like? Is there an analogy between the terror tunnels in Gaza and these connections between San Diego and Mexico?
Well, having personally been in the tunnels, and obviously not in Gaza, but I will say this, and here we go again, San Diego and Imperial County, we are the tunnel capital of the Southwest border. And why? Two reasons. The Sinaloa cartel, Chapo, specialize in tunnels. But probably more importantly is because of our clay-like soil and composition in our geographic region is beneficial to creating those tunnels. So it's hard to have a tunnel under the Rio Grande. It's hard to tunnel into sand that caves in. It takes a lot of work. You need a population base south of the border where they can hide all of the soil that they're moving out of the ground and do so in a clandestine manner. And you also need the same north of the border. So the tunnel that was just found the other day is supported and was investigated by the Border Patrol, Homeland Security Investigations, Tunnel Task Force. So we have a task force that's HIDTA funded, where we supply equipment, of which, you know, we can't talk about, but equipment and training to those task force officers and federal agents to allow them to detect where those tunnels are. And so they're very sophisticated. This tunnel had lighting, ventilation, had a rail system where they can move human beings, they can move drugs back and forth. So the tunnels are few and far between, but very significant. And when you talk about a threat—
Are they cement enforced, kind of like the ones in Gaza?
No. So these tunnels are all in, some of these now are fortified for training purposes with concrete, but what they do is they dig them out, they have ventilation, they put in lighting, they put in a rail system so that they can move people back and forth. And it takes a long time for a tunnel, and it's very specific engineering. So Once we find a tunnel in the United States, the government will put concrete into the tunnel and fill it up. However, they don't do that in Mexico. So they'll leave that tunnel opening. They'll obviously close the top of it. But quite oftentimes what they find is that the cartel will leave it alone for months or years. And then they'll start going offshoots of that particular tunnel. And they'll try to build it into the United States and north of the border, utilizing the infrastructure that's in place or being built close to the border down in Otay Mesa and in those areas. Because, look, we're always looking for anomalies, right? When you fly over it, we have assets through the National Guard, the Army Corps of Engineers, obviously your federal agencies down at the border. So it's hard to move that dirt out, because if you start seeing a building with dump trucks coming in and out of it, and it's a building that manufactures, let's say, televisions and a maquiladora or something like that, it's that game of which one of these things is not like the other. And so it's very technological. It takes a lot of time and manpower to detect those tunnels, but it is 100% a legitimate threat to our national security, because as you see in other parts of the world, people being smuggled through those tunnels, weapons of mass destruction, and fentanyl, and they usually will utilize those tunnels.
Human trafficking.
Yeah, the hardcore drugs that come through those, because as we know, marijuana is mostly cultivated here in California and outsourced, exported to other states. So we don't see as much marijuana coming in. So it's your cocaine, methamphetamine, fentanyl, human trafficking coming through those tunnels.
Yeah. And how much binational cooperation are you seeing now? Are things better now between Mexico, United States, and, you know, and as you see it in, on that southwest border, more cooperation, less cooperation? Are they going to fill the tunnels on their end, or?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a foreign country. And I will say that since this administration has come into power, I've heard from our federal agency representatives that they do, particularly the Border Patrol, they do have good working relationships with SEDENA and the federal agencies in Mexico. That Mexico is now, if you look at the border, there's hardly anybody crossing from Yuma. And I'll look at our AOR because of San Diego.
Zero. They said zero. Zero. Illegal crossing. Lots of legal crossing every day, but zero illegal.
Yeah, there was a briefing that we had a month ago where one of the Border Patrol chiefs said between Yuma, Arizona, and the Bull Ring, the ocean, which is about 165, 170 miles of border between Mexico and California, there was one crossing in a particular 24-hour period. I'm not sure who that individual was that assessed that they could cross, but there was one crossing, and it is much different than it was years ago, with thousands of individuals crossing a day. And as you know, the cartels are having to shift their tactics, right? Because I say this to everybody, whether it's in Mexico, and to answer your point from earlier, yes, I think the relationships with the authorities in Mexico have improved. They are now searching, if you look just south of the border at the port of entry in San Ysidro and Tecate, you can see that the Mexican military has set up checkpoints that are pre-primary, what we call no man's land pre-primary, prior to getting up to the booth with Customs and Border Protection, the folks that wear blue, CBP, Office of Field Operations. The Mexicans are conducting their own searches south of the border. So we're seeing quite a reduction in methamphetamine and fentanyl seizures at our ports of entry since this administration. But getting back to what I was going to talk about earlier, so the cartels are opportunistic. They are stone cold killers, but they are savvy businessmen. And whether it's theft of petroleum, theft of agriculture, theft of electronics, goods and services, textiles, drugs, human trafficking, they're going to make a profit. So what we're seeing right now is a pivot by the cartels because they were making a lot of money smuggling people over by the thousands a day in human trafficking. And since that border is now closed, we're seeing a shift out to the Pacific Ocean. So I don't think you and I don't think a lot of people have discussed prior maritime domain awareness, which is something unique to our HIDAs. So not only do we face the subterranean threat, the threats across the border, the threats from UAS, unmanned aerial systems coming across the border, but we also face a maritime threat. And that is something that I'm currently working with the Office of National Drug Control Policy and the White House for our FY 2026 threat assessment, is that there are less incidents, but more people that are being smuggled across via the waterways. And it used to be $5,000 to $7,000 for someone to be smuggled across through a land border type scenario through the East County. And it would depend if you were from China or Russia or other parts of the world, because you had about 135 different countries with people that were crossing the border, and it would vary in price. But the cartels control that coming across the border. $5,000 to $7,000 for someone coming across from Mexico has now gone to $15,000 to $20,000 per person. So that's why you're seeing in the last couple months here in our area of responsibility, our AOR, that you're seeing, unfortunately, the migrant deaths with the capsizing of the Pongas and the pleasure craft and people not being able to swim. You're seeing more maritime individual being smuggled across through the Pacific Ocean route. So we are constantly facing the threats as the cartels change their tactics, techniques, and procedures.
Important to do, and also sad.
Very sad.
That human toll. You're seeing less crossings, and we're seeing less fentanyl deaths. Is there an association between the supply and the mortality, or not yet? Because the mortality that we're counting is like a year ago, and the seizures that we're seeing are more recent.
Yeah, I think, you know, as people's drug use behaviors, what I learned a long time ago is people's patterns change. There are generations that want to tune in, drop out, abuse psychedelics. There are generations that want to go fast and abuse cocaine and methamphetamine. There are generations that are addicted to opioids, right? And so I think with all of the prevention measures and all of the outreach, DEA's One Pill Can Kill, the National HIDA has what's called the Overdose Response Strategy, where you have drug intelligence officers working with public health analysts to get out naloxone distribution, all of the things that we've been doing the last 5-6 years to reduce overdose deaths from opioids, illicit opioids in our county, has had a positive effect. I mean, but I also remember talking to Dr. Steve Campen, who said that we may be at the point.
Our medical examiner.
That's correct. Our medical examiner here in San Diego, recently retired, really well respected, who said that perhaps there's been such a time period of individuals that engaged in risky drug use behavior that we see less and less of those individuals. A lot of them sadly overdosed and died, and less people now, because of all the prevention efforts and treatment and everything, are inclined to use those type of drugs. And so we're seeing less come across the border as far as that. But like I said, you can never rest, because what we thought was going to be the end of plant-based drugs. So it takes a lot to rely on heroin as far as growing opium, scoring poppies, processing it, turning into diacetylmorphine south of the border, or in Burma, Laos, Thailand, Afghanistan, Mexico. And they have to rely on a lot of different factors, cocaine with coca plants and all that. We thought we would see the end of plant-based drugs in favor of synthetic, which is fentanyl and methamphetamine, because you can manufacture it in a much smaller area and can control the distribution routes. We're a little surprised to see that cocaine is making a big comeback. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but we'll be talking about this for the next couple of years and the individuals. And of course, a lot of people that overdosed and died, sadly, thought that they were just using meth or cocaine.
Xanax pill.
Yep. M30s, counterfeit, oxy, all of those things. And unfortunately, it was adulterated with fentanyl. So that's our biggest threat now. Other than meth, I'm going to say methamphetamine is our number one threat. Fentanyl is going to go down to number two, but cocaine is rising. Every year as a HIDTA director, we're asked our primary, secondary, tertiary drug threats. And pretty much if you look at a map of the United States, blue, I always say this because blue represents methamphetamine. The entire country 10 years ago was blue. And then we started seeing pockets of red in the Northeast, and it spread, and red is represented by fentanyl. And now we're seeing the majority of the country, except in a couple regions, is all red. You will start to see that methamphetamine is going to come back as our number one. And then perhaps in the coming years, cocaine will be our secondary threat.
Right. Which is, you know, all drugs are bad. But as far as the rate of death, that could actually take us back to our baseline of what I call the good old days when opioid prescriptions were the big killer. We're still, you know, we're still not to that baseline.
Well, look at all the outreach. I mean, you're in the medical profession, and look at all the outreach and the different practices with physicians prescribing opioids. I mean, I remember having back surgery 12 years ago, and, you know, they were like, hey, let us know what you need. It was when you walk into the doctor's
office. And you got 300 pills.
The pain threshold, right?
Yeah.
How are you on the pain threshold? Is it a sad face, really, really sad, happy? Where are you? And I don't see that anymore. I mean, you go in and they're
we went to safe prescribing, right? There's a role for opioids. And if you have back surgery, you want opioids and you deserve them. That's what they're for, but not 300 pills. Right. So, we fixed that. And then we got a worse problem with fentanyl. I would predict, and I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but that if we get on the supply side to the extent that, you know, President Trump wants to, with, you know, shutting off the supply of fentanyl, especially, that the deaths of overdoses will come down a lot more dramatically. I mean, nothing is zero, because like you said, we'll have cocaine, we'll have other things, other problems. But a lot of people died of fentanyl that were not addicted to opioids. They were tricked. They were poisoned.
When we see thousands of pounds of fentanyl, we look at that. I mean, and you look at microgram quantities that can be lethal to individuals, and you see thousands of pounds that you seize on an annual basis. We look at all of that and say those are lives saved. That is the end goal for everybody that's in narcotic law enforcement, federal, state, local, in the United States. Your prosecutors is reducing those overdose deaths, reducing the availability of the supply, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes in previous administration, they would say that we're in the supply reduction side, right? And we always push back saying, hey, we're law enforcement. Yes, our mission is to decrease the availability of the illicit drugs. And that is a core component to reducing overdose deaths.
Right. And, you know, like you mentioned earlier, people say the war on drugs has failed and you won't arrest our way out of it. I don't know about the war on drugs. Like, what does that mean? We should be against drugs. I don't know if you want to call it a war. But we also won't naloxone our way out. We won't treat our way out. But we can educate and prevent our way out. And I'm always amazed by how much law enforcement invests in prevention. And that's another HIDTA program I want you to show off about.
We have been on the cutting edge We're of the 33 HIDAs, we're one of the original HIDA for prevention. We have great folks. Amy Hendel, Alma Babcock are our drug demand reduction specialists. They work tirelessly to work with NGOs, 501c3s, with the National Guard to get out into the schools. They put out every 2 years our marijuana impact report on California. Shameless yep. plug.
No, we will talk about that.
They do a great job on that, but it is very important, like you said. So we're not going to rest or treat our way out of it. We need to educate the future generations about the harms the drug addiction cause to not only themselves, but their family and their society. But you had said something earlier about the war on drugs, and I get very passionate about this because, you know, when you talk about war, you talk about conflict and you talk about lives, weapons, and, you know, nine of the top 10
death and destruction.
Nine of the top 10 most violent cities in the world are in Mexico. And for, you know, Tijuana is right up there. San Diego County will have maybe 35 homicides. San Diego City will have 35 homicides. The county is very low as a whole, maybe 65, 70 this year. Whereas Tijuana will have 1,700 to 1,800 homicides. So, and you look at the weapons, we recently got a report because DEA and the San Diego County Sheriff's Department are starting marijuana enforcement operations, working together to try to target the illegal grows, and they've been doing a good job. But last in FY24, there were 90 weapons, 90 firearms seized in grow sites. Increasingly, what we're seeing on the streets are weapons. So I take it personally when people say, oh, it's not a war on drugs, because the cartels are armed and they're killing people at record numbers south of the border. The individuals that traffic drugs are armed. The individuals that operate safe houses and stash houses are armed. The gang members that traffic into the communities in smaller quantities are armed. We're seeing a proliferation of privately manufactured firearms. The HIDA funds what's called the Ghost Gun Apprehension Team, which is alcohol, tobacco, firearms, led by the San Diego Police Department. So federal, state, and local agencies working together to address a certain crime. So we're seeing a lot of weapons, and we see violence associated with it. So I'm going to come out and say, because you give me the latitude to do so, and that's why I go on this podcast, you're damn right it's a war on drugs. And I'm not going to back away from that, because law enforcement officers are sacrificing their lives, and we're seeing violence against police, sometimes at record numbers. So yeah, we have to be armed because the cartel's armed. We didn't ask for this fight. They're bringing the drugs across, and to control their shipments, their profit, and their territories, they're increasingly armed and violent to do so.
It's interesting. I did a podcast with Twen Voten, who is an anthropologist, author, photographer. And if you see his pictures, the pictures that he takes of, you know, the drugs and people addicted to drugs in the areas in you know, in the Tenderloin where people are using drugs, and you see pictures of Sudan and areas of war and conflict, there's a lot of similarities too in the human toll and the pictures.
And to me, and I'm going to say it, and I've said it to everybody around the country, if you look at what California has done, and it started with Prop 215 in 1996 with medical marijuana, and went to Prop 47, which reduced possession of personal amounts of methamphetamine, cocaine, heroin, and fentanyl to misdemeanors, and the normalization of drug usage in the state of California. And you look at where we are now with, on a weekly basis, with ODMAP, the Overdose Detection Mapping Application Program, which the HIDA supports all over the United States. We're seeing over 5,000 overdoses in the state of California on a weekly basis. And I know less people are dying from it, but you really look at the consequences of those laws, like Prop 47, which raised the property value to $950 for theft, and you started to see mass amounts of retail theft. You go into our cities and you see individuals smoking fentanyl, smoking methamphetamine, shooting meth on the streets, laying there in their own feces, and it's really sad. And yeah, that
third,
never
third world. It made parts of California look like a third world.
And Dr. Lev, that never occurred. And I want to say, people say, "Oh, you want the good old days?" You damn right, I want the good old days. Because when I was on patrol, remember, armed with my pupillometer and my little pen light, I would be able to go down there and see an individual that was, you know, hiding in a bathroom, walk in, see them doing drugs. They may have had a small amount on them, but that was a felony. And they would be booked into county jail. And once they were booked into county jail, they were then evaluated medically. They were given treatment. And it wasn't just about throwing them in jail. It was getting them the services to allow them to get off the street and get back off their feet. And prior to the voters, overwhelmingly by 68%, approving and passing Prop 36 to again make, and with certain restrictions, your third arrest for possession of methamphetamine, cocaine, heroin, fentanyl into a felony, you're starting to see people that are now being prosecuted, being held accountable, and they're going to get the help instead of getting a ticket. So my son Cameron said that for the first couple of years in his patrol, a lot of folks were just getting tickets for possession of fentanyl. Over and over, they were getting tickets. And then later, they would find that same individual dead of an overdose, apparent overdose, and that individual had been cited multiple times or contacted multiple times with no citation, and nothing ever happened.
You know, not having deterrence is not compassionate. People think, oh, it's just a ticket. It's not compassionate to have that person dead. Having deterrence, it can be compassionate. And I think people have misplaced compassion, which is actually cruel, by allowing drug use and saying that it's okay. You're killing people, and that's not compassion. And I think the fix, Prop 36, is a fix to the Prop 47 that kind of allowed, you know, theft repeatedly up to $950. It's like, if it wasn't more than that, then, oh, well, you know, why bother? And as a physician, I just saw open drug carry. People used to like hide their drugs, and now they like openly carry their baggies wherever they want on their body because it's not a big deal. And now I think we have a compassionate fix to that with Prop 36 that opened up drug courts that we couldn't really have in California, and incentivizing people to get treatment. And it's a deterrence. Having deterrence for bad things is a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, drug abuse adversely impacts at a higher rate your homeless population. We recently, just last week, as a matter of fact, had the Substance Use Overdose Prevention Task Force, SUOPT, preliminary report card. And it really is disproportionate as far as the adverse impacts of drug use on the homeless population. So we have, in my estimation, the best district attorney in the United States of America, in Summer Steffen. She's amazing. She's compassionate. But firm but fair, I would characterize her. The prosecutions for drug possession, minor drug possession, has increased, obviously, since Prop 36 passed and went into effect late December. And in my estimation, a lot of those people are now getting the help that they so desperately need, and not being overlooked anymore. I don't fault anybody for going out and doing what they had to do. Dr. Rahul Gupta, who was the previous director of ONDCP under the Biden administration, one of the things I particularly agreed with him on is he said this: if you're in law enforcement, be the best at doing that and supply reduction. If you're in the medical profession, be the best at treating your patients and providing all of the substance use disorder medication. If you're in education prevention, do that. Everybody has to do what they have to do to try to get through this. But I felt that in California particularly, and in Oregon, if you look at the laws in Oregon as well, Oregon had a law, and I think it was well intended, that their legislature had to walk back last year, which basically decriminalized drug possession.
I thought it was a mistake from the start, because they promised treatment, but it really was never treatment. They promised screening that you have a problem. What does that do?
And people aren't able to rationalize their addiction. Like, you know what? Today I'm getting up. It's Tuesday and I'm done with smoking meth and I'm going to get into treatment. So a lot of times they need that. So you see Oregon, their legislature walking it back, eliminated completely, going back to the drug laws as they had previous to that. And you're seeing California. So a lot of the last 10 years, decade or so of how the public perceives drugs is going back to more with consequences, which we feel is going to have a positive impact on the overdose death rate.
You know, I knew you years ago when Prop 47 passed, and you said to me, this is the worst thing ever. This is the worst thing. And I didn't quite understand the consequences until I lived the consequences. And so it's nice that you're able to see full circle that that mistake has been fixed.
I'm not happy to say that I was right about that, but I mean, it just, it seemed very logical that if you put drugs in the hands of individuals and there's no consequences, that addiction is going to overcome all logic and reason. And what we didn't know many years ago was the effect that fentanyl would have on it to come in and just absolutely decimate our communities.
To a huge degree. All right. So we talked about the blue of marijuana, the red of fentanyl. And now let's talk about the green and the beautiful report that was a lot of labor that came out. What is that report, that marijuana impact report?
So every 2 years, our drug demand reduction specialists take data from California Healthy Kids Survey. They take national data, California Highway Patrol, California Department of Public Health, and dozens of other data sets. And they put together a report on how marijuana overall is impacting the state of California. And so I'm really proud of the group because it's not been easy for them. I've been the HIDA director for 8 years. So this is my fourth report. And I will say that 8 years ago was easier for them to get the data sets. We've seen with the state of California, they're not collecting a lot of the data. And we theorize, right, and I'm only going to say this, that with the legalization of marijuana, both recreational and medicinal in California, that the marijuana industry lied to a lot of cities, counties, municipalities about the profitability of marijuana in their geographic regions. So the profit margin is 75% below projected revenue for marijuana, and about 75% of the marijuana that's cultivated in California is now exported out of the state of California. And a pound of marijuana sells for much more, the high-grade THC marijuana sells for much more than a pound of methamphetamine. So the black market is thriving in California for marijuana. And we were all led to believe that once marijuana was legalized, the vast majority of users would go to dispensaries, legal dispensaries, pay the taxes, be down the road. And we've not seen that because, and we said this, and hate to be right, but why would somebody go to a dispensary and purchase marijuana for a much higher rate than they could go to the black market and purchase it without any fear of being prosecuted for it? So with all the marijuana laws, you see a lot of jury nullification with individuals that are on juries. If somebody had 1,000 pounds of marijuana, the folks on the jury are like, well, it's legal in California, which it is. So prosecutors on the federal side and at the DA's office and for the attorney general's office have immense difficulty prosecuting illegal marijuana cases. So that's why you're seeing the sheriff's department, who for years has led the efforts in the county to dismantle your illicit, unlicensed dispensaries, because it's really hard to tell what's licensed and unlicensed when you're the consumer. You walk in, it's got the green sign, and it looks like a legitimate place, and it's not, and they close it down. But remember this, it's all about profits. Everything we're talking about, whether it's marijuana, meth, coke, heroin, fentanyl, counterfeit, oxy, Xanax, it's all about profits, and the illegal drug market is thriving. But I wanted to bring some stats to you, and I never like reading stats, but to me, this is what sticks out from the marijuana report, because they do an executive summary. You see that the THC content, which is the psychoactive tetrahydrocannabinol, psychoactive ingredient marijuana, used to be 4% in 95. It's now 16%, which is an increase of 308%. So the marijuana that people in our age, 50s, 60s, late 40s and up, said, oh, it's just weed, right? A lot of people did that. It was 2 to 3%. Wrong. It's now 16% on average.
And that's just the flower. The edibles could be like, and the waxes could be 99%.
Oh yeah. When you're talking concentrated cannabis, BHO, yeah. Butane, honey oil, 95%. So, but the sad thing is from 2017 to 2022, past month marijuana vaping more than doubled among college and non-college students, and individuals 12 and older continue to have a higher rate of past month use of marijuana from 2015 to 2023. So there are some really devastating impacts of marijuana in our state. So we see it. A lot of people are driving under the influence, which has devastating consequences to all of us, because there's not one of us that doesn't get into our cars and get on the roads on a daily basis.
Deadly consequences, right? Yeah. And unfortunately, we're not, you know, going after that and or testing for it like we should be.
I always said this, as far as marijuana use, you know, when people smell marijuana in California, in a public setting, they're like, oh yeah, you smell that weed, whatever. Some people chuckle, laugh it off, whatever, like, whoa, bro. When somebody lights up a cigarette in California and you can smell the smoke from a cigarette tobacco, people are like, get it out of here. I'm going to get cancer. Get out of here. My lungs are impacted.
I know.
And
yeah.
That same visceral
reaction. That's the education
reaction
we had, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And
right.
And
but why is it okay that I'm having, you know, ice cream cones with my little grandkids and we're smelling that and that's okay?
Correct. And you look at the way.
And there are secondhand effects of cannabis smoke, too.
And that's in your era. That's in your wheelhouse, right? I mean, we've always said that. Why would you want those carcinogens from smoking marijuana if you don't want cigarettes? If cigarettes are so harmful, why isn't marijuana smoking just as harmful as well? But it's sad because marijuana used by 18 to 25-year-olds has now surpassed their use of cigarettes. So more people are smoking marijuana in California between the ages of 18 and 25 than are smoking. Good news that smoking's decreasing. Glad to see that. Glad to see all the outreach, but would love to see more campaign and outreach for young individuals who smoke marijuana in California.
Right, to protect their brain. And the other thing in the report, and I thank you for that, is the suicide data that you added that we have. We don't have that data, sadly, statewide, because the state's not collecting the data, but we've seen that the number one drug for people who died by suicide under the age of 25 was marijuana, higher than alcohol or anything else.
And I hear a lot of people say they treat it to calm their nerves, they have depression, and they smoke that. And I tell them that marijuana can be a combination of all drugs. It can be a stimulant. It can have effects like an opioid. It is certainly a hallucinogenic, right? And so it's very dangerous in the fact that it can give the user all of that symptomology.
Right. And risk of psychosis. And, you know, like we know, not everybody who smokes cigarettes is going to get cancer, but it's a risk factor. Not everybody who uses marijuana is going to get psychosis, but it's a risk factor, especially to the young, growing, vulnerable brain.
Yeah, and you have higher incidence of abuse of cocaine, methamphetamine, fentanyl, prescription drugs of individuals that smoke marijuana. I can tell you this definitively, Dr. Lev, that I never met anybody who was abusing drugs in my 35 years that started their first drug use with snorting cocaine or smoking meth or fentanyl. It always, everybody, to a man, a woman, people, you know, under juveniles, under the age of 18, started with marijuana.
Yeah, definitely a gateway buy, and it makes sense with the dopamine priming of the brain at that young age. Seizures, marijuana seizures. So marijuana is legal in California. So what's the deal with all these seizures and reports of record number of seizures of marijuana? Why are there seizures if marijuana is legal?
Well, because what we're seizing is illicitly grown marijuana. So we didn't even talk about that, but there in looking 24, the Sheriff's Department seized 2,540 pounds of processed marijuana in fiscal year 24, and they are on pass to almost double that in FY25 as of April 28. So what you're seeing is foreign nationals, particularly Chinese criminal organizations that are coming in, and they're exposing the laws to their advantage, that the prosecutions are few and far between. They have illegal grow houses. They set up businesses where they take over residences and they grow marijuana illicitly and then profit from exporting it out. So when you see these hoop houses in the Inland Empire, Riverside, San Bernardino, they take advantage of human trafficking. You just saw a huge takedown 2 days ago in Riverside, where there were, I believe, 67 individuals arrested. The vast majority of them were here illegally, undocumented migrants that were forced into working in those conditions, hazardous conditions with soil, pesticides, lighting, chemicals, all of those things present. But they take advantage of the fact that they buy cheap acreage and they set up these grow sites and they harvest and they export the marijuana to other parts of the country, where you're seeing 25%, 16 to 25% off the vine, and they're making enormous profits from that. And like I said before, with the 90 weapons that were seized in San Diego County alone in FY24, you're seeing that these are dangerous individuals, armed and ready to protect their supply.
Yeah. So when people read about, you know, a bunch of marijuana seized, it's not like your average person growing their little plant and why should that be seized? We're talking about, you know, foreign nationals, even public lands, destroying our environment, you know, cleaning up a marijuana grow is like, you know, like cleaning up an oil fill. It's not easy, and it does a lot of damage to the land, to the water supply. And the human trafficking, people don't think, what's human trafficking? And again, I did a podcast with Sebastian Rotello, writer for ProPublica, and he did, you know, great expose, really understanding the problem with these illegal grows. So it's not, again, when you talk about, oh, we seized marijuana, it's not just seizing some pot plants. This is, again, drug cartels.
This is organized crime controlled by the drug cartels. So for years, there was a lot of illegal grows, illicit grows on public lands, particularly Siskiyou, Shasta, Humboldt, Northern California, the Golden Triangle, what they call it. But now they are increasingly using private lands and grow houses, large-scale grow houses, for the illicit growing of and distribution of marijuana. So it is a cartel-run business. Like I said, weapons, human trafficking, and high profit margins. And we're starting to see a lot of other states, Oklahoma, the Midwest, they're having to change their drug laws. They're having to adapt because folks, particularly the Chinese nationals, which are particularly adept with financing, purchasing land, purchasing real estate, straw purchasing for the intent to cultivate marijuana because the profit margin is so high in it.
Yeah. So they're taking advantage of our own laws.
Correct.
Yeah.
And you're seeing U.S. attorneys having to go back again and now prosecute federally some of these crimes. I'll be back in Oklahoma City the second week in July for a one-day meeting to particularly address what's going on in the Midwest with our marijuana impact group.
Wow, that's great. So good luck with that. And thank you for including the data and including ISAC, the International Academy on Science and Impact in Cannabis, to allowing them to review the report with a medical eye. And that was very nice. You work closely with the Office of National Drug Control Policy, with our future drug czar, who will be starting any day now, Director Sarah Carter. What would your advice be to her starting her job? What is it she need to know? Any advice of what she should be reading?
Well, I had the opportunity to meet with nominated Director Carter in Texas last month. She's extremely engaged. We were all very impressed with her enthusiasm and her passion. I think to be the director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, we've gotten away from using the term as our drug czar, but she will be the face of our nation's drug threat. She will be the face to reduce overdose deaths. She will be the face of the administration dealing with all of the cartels and saving lives. So I was really, really happy that she was so engaged. This isn't her first rodeo. When she was a correspondent with Fox News, she covered a lot of cartel-related activity from Mexico, from other parts of the world. She received an award from Jim Carroll, who under President Trump's first administration was the director of ONDCP because of her work. So she's very passionate about that. She advocates for the HIDA program. I will say this, that we just recently learned from the president's budget that they recommended a $102 million decrease to the to the FY26 budget for the HIDA program. But I'm very confident with all of our congressional outreach on both sides of the aisle that the HIDA program, with the 30 years of proven record with, targeting the cartels and keeping our communities safe, that we won't sustain any of those cuts. The next couple of weeks will be really critical with markups in the House Appropriations Committees. But to Sarah Carter, we stand committed and we stand behind her. The 33 directors and deputy directors, she has an impact on all of our communities everywhere in the United States. And I think she's going to be a very passionate and competent leader of that. Because when you have compassion for individuals and real life experience, of which all of us do in fighting this war on drugs, I think once you bring that and you convey that message and you organize and you're able to, and that's the good thing about the HIDA program, you're taking federal money and you're bringing it into geographic regions for those experts to determine how best to address the threat. And I think she really understands that. And she is going to foster that relationship with our federal, state, and local law enforcement partners. She understands how we distribute intelligence, because a big part of the HIDA program is so local agencies, state agencies, and federal agencies don't exist in silos. We bring them together for the betterment of narcotic enforcement and public safety. And she understands how important the intelligence component is, the prevention treatment component, and certainly the enforcement component. So I can't wait for her to come on board. We've been honored for the last three directors of ONDCP to host them here at the San Diego Imperial Valley HIDA. Our federal, state, and local partners do a great job of putting them into tunnels, taking them out on the Pacific Ocean, taking them up oftentimes in National Guard, Black Hawk helicopters to see what's south of the border to get a better perspective of the threat that we face with all the individuals crossing the border. So hopefully in the next couple months after confirmation, Director Carter, Acting Director Carter, will visit our AOR and Dr. Lev. We'd be honored if you would escort her and do the briefing like you did years ago for Director Carroll and what's going on with the medical community.
Yeah, I was very happy that Director Carroll, I said doctor, his very when he came into office, San Diego was his very first place that he came to visit. So, yeah, and that was a special visit. I'm sure we'll do the same thing for Director Carroll. And do you have any fear that HIDA program and the drug-free community program will be DOGED? That there was the talk about moving those offices out of ONDCP and into Department of Justice. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, I don't want to say threat, but the possibility is there. But I will say this, that being under ONDCP, like I said, with them providing oversight of the program and allowing autonomy, that our Senate and House members all realize that that's important to their geographic regions, taking that federal money. So I don't fear any DOGE, because if you look at the president's priorities and the Office of National Drug Control priorities, they're exactly in sync with reducing the supply, reducing overdose deaths. Those are the things that this program was built to do, and those are the things that we are doing. And we're having measurable outcomes in the decrease in overdose deaths and the increase in interdicting supplies all over the United States of illicit drugs. So we are geared toward, like I said, 95% of our funding is law enforcement. And the vast majority of our funding, 98% in my HIDA of that federal money, goes to state and local agencies. That's really important. So you look at the La Mesa Police Department, you look at the El Centro Police Department, Imperial, some of the smaller agencies, not just San Diego PD, San Diego County Sheriffs that have roughly 2,000 officers and deputies assigned to both, but the smaller agencies are allowed to be force multipliers and not just have drugs come into their city, but to be proactive and to go out and to target transnational criminal organizations because they're part of these task forces. So you have Escondido Police Department that works with a fentanyl abatement suppression team. They're able to go into these task forces and have positive impacts in their community at arresting these cartel members, drug traffickers, and gang members that are moving the drugs into the communities and killing people. And that's the benefit of the HIDA program. And I think that anybody that would see that, including DOGE or anybody in Washington, D.C., realizes that we all live in communities. People look at Washington, D.C. as separate, but those folks have to go back to their communities in Maryland, the District of Columbia, in Virginia, and HIDA exists in those states as well. So I'm excited for the future of it. I know that there are budget cuts, but we feel we're going to do well in that area.
I'm always amazed about how much, and you say like 98% goes into law enforcement, but how much public health law enforcement is involved in. From the days that La Mesa, again, a small police department, were the first in the county to get naloxone and use that in the field, to what you're doing in schools and in education and in using prevention science, from research by scientists into the schools. And then my encounter, I never heard of HIDA. The first time I've heard of HIDA was when I was working with the medical community on safe prescribing, and we needed some money to print some brochures, and a bunch of people with guns said that they'll pay for it. It's like, who are these people? And since then, again, what I learned as a physician, I a lot of that, I come from a public safety, because otherwise I don't really know what my patients are using, especially new things, unless I learn that from law enforcement.
Well, the millions of dollars, so by congressional mandate, are $300 million, roughly, it's now 298.5, but 5% of that can go toward prevention efforts. And we've always realized, and been really priority in this county and forward thinking that we do want education and prevention to be a core component and principle of it. The Washington, Baltimore, HIDA, and the Northwest HIDA have treatment components. So they're able to take their 5% of their overall budget and put it to facilities for treatment. So when you look at the HIDA program, we pay for leases that allow task forces to operate. We pay for the Law Enforcement Coordination Center in Imperial County that allows federal, state, and local resources to come together for our leaders to all talk at meeting locations, safety equipment, training. Obviously is a huge component of what we fund at HIDA because we want our officers to be safe and more efficient and better serve the public. And we believe training is a big component of that. So there are a lot of tentacles to the HIDA program. And the very fact that we have a great relationship, because it used to be the meth strike force and then PDATF, Prescription Drug Abuse Task Force, bringing in the medical community and allowing them to interact with law enforcement. So you bring in your expertise and we see it. The biggest benefit is the fact that we see it from your perspective. And then in turn, you see it from law enforcement's perspective. And that to me is what's unique about our region is that, like I said, we all come together for the sole goal of reducing overdose deaths and making our communities healthy and safety. Live Well San Diego, whether it's California Department of Public Health, we're all in the same goal of making our communities safer.
Right. And we did that with the opioid prescriptions. It is not a crisis anymore. And we did that not through naloxone or buprenorphine. We did that through prevention and safe prescribing. And we had a whole county together on that way before the CDC ever stepped in with their guidelines. So that is wonderful. And if you had an elevator moment with President Trump, what would be your message?
Mr. President, thank you for your support. The HIDA is committed to furthering your administration's priorities. We'll continue to be on the front line. We're dedicated and energized and continue to serve the public.
Nice message. Director David King, thank you so much for joining us on High Truths, for all that you do, for the cooperation with the three Ps, public health, public safety, and prevention, and to me, for the personal advice that you've given me and support that you've had over the years.
Dr. Lev, you are our hero. You're a champion. We respect you immensely because you tell the truth, whether you think it'll benefit you or not. And we look forward to standing shoulder to shoulder with you and reducing overdose deaths in our county, the state of California, and across the United States of America. So thank you on behalf of everybody in public safety, the National HIDA Program, because you are quite a treasure. We're selfish and we say, hey, she came from San Diego because you have a national reputation. The HIDA directors think of you as quite a resource and a treasure. So thank you to you and to all your listeners.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.